listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in today, and tomorrow will be my last day in the seat. A special thanks to the Tom Hartman Program and the crew for allowing us, Eric, this great opportunity to speak to a national audience. But we do have a special guest on the line, so we'll get to the Freedom Lines after that. We have Steve Burton on the line, and he is a spokesman. Barton. No, it says Burton here. Oh, it's Barton. Okay, so we have Steve Barton on the line, and he is spokesperson for Mayors Against Illegal Guns. And also, Steve was unfortunately at the scene of the shooting, the mass shooting in Aurora, Colorado, that movie theater. So without further ado, let me get to Steve right now on the line as we speak. Steve, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you here, Steve. Steve, tell us a little bit about this particular organization, Mayors Against Illegal Guns, because right now there's the big debate going on. As you just, I'm sure, heard, the Senate has had enough votes to move forward, at least for debate, with respect to some gun control measures. But
right.
How did this organization come about? How long has it been in existence, and what is its primary purpose?
Well, you know, it's a pretty unique organization. It has pretty humble beginnings. In 2006, Mayor Bloomberg of New York City and Mayor Tom Menino of Boston were basically, you know, fed up with the violence in their cities. Especially Mayor Bloomberg, you know, he that year had three NYPD officers die within a pretty short period of time, and they were just gunned down in the line of duty. And he was just so frustrated, and I think as most people who have followed Mayor Bloomberg in the news know, you know, he speaks his mind. And he was so upset he decided to convene a meeting of several mayors at his mansion in New York City, and they basically decided that as mayors they have a pretty unique understanding of public safety. You know, a lot of mayors win and lose their elections on their public safety records, and so they figured they could leverage a somewhat unique role and voice in this debate that for so long, I mean, the gun debate has been so stale. And really there has been no progress. And so since then, it's grown into an organization with more than 900 mayors, representing 45 states, over 70 million Americans. We have 1.5 million grassroots supporters. And it's really just the leading national organization working on this issue now.
That is absolutely amazing. Let me ask you this, Steve. With respect to illegal guns and illegal gun purchases, do we have sort of an idea of what percent of gun purchases happen to be illegal gun purchases or illegal transfers?
Well, I mean, you know, a gun becomes illegal when it's diverted out of the legal market, whether that's by traffickers or, you know, by criminals misusing those guns, using them in homicides or other violent crimes. I mean, we don't have a great sense of that. I mean, we know it's a problem because as many as 40% of all gun sales are transferred privately, which under federal law means there's no background check required at all. So you can imagine, I mean, you set up two lines at the airport, one, you know, has a metal detector and the other doesn't. That's essentially the kind of system that we have with our gun market nationally. And so you can imagine what system traffickers, you know, and criminals use. And, I mean, one statistic that kind of speaks to this is at least 30% of guns that are involved in investigations of crime guns, they've, you know, passed through a gun show at some point. And at gun shows, as you may or may not know, I mean, you have licensed dealers, but you also have private sellers side by side. And it's really just a nexus for you know, an easy way for criminals to access guns.
So let me ask you this. With respect to that private purchase, because I was reading up on that and trying to do some research on that, it seems as though that will be addressed from this bipartisan group of senators, Tomey and Manchin, who are putting out their ideas on the Senate floor. Do you think that will be part of this, that people who transfer ownership of a gun privately will still have to go through some type of background check as well, or is that going to continue to be a loophole? Because it sounds like a gaping loophole, as wide as the Grand Canyon, from what you're telling me.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. It's a huge loophole, and it really undermines, if anything, our right, our Second Amendment right, because, you know, you have criminals essentially misusing guns and giving gun owners, why, you know, generally a bad name. And so the Manchin-Toomey compromise would close that loophole to an extent. It would require background checks at gun shows and via online gun sales. So any private sales that occur in a commercial context, quote unquote.
But isn't that for the primary purchase, Steve? That's not necessarily a transfer, right? That's just for the primary purchase of a gun.
Well, no, it's any time you're selling a gun at a gun show or online, whether you're a licensed dealer or a private citizen, you will be required to conduct a background check no matter what. And that currently is not the case.
Right.
Currently, private citizens and private sellers are completely exempt from that requirement.
So what would happen?
We were hoping for, Senator Schumer's bill, which was originally introduced, and which the Toomey Mansion Amendment seeks to change. I mean, that would require background checks for any gun sale, with reasonable exceptions for family transfers. And so this just kind of scales it back slightly. But the important thing is that it still maintains record keeping of these background checks, which allows the law enforcement to trace guns and to enforce the law. Because, I mean, if you require background checks, but you don't require anyone to keep a record of that check, then there's no way for police to know if it's ever, if that check has ever been conducted in the first place.
Right. So speak to that a little bit more directly, because some of the NRA members and gun ownership proponents say that they fear there will be some type of national database that's created and a national registry, and that's just another step towards a slippery slope where people will end up having their guns confiscated because we'll know exactly who has what. Speak to that a little bit.
Right. Well, I'll say if they truly believe that, I mean, that's essentially an indictment of the current background check system, because really, this bill only seeks to expand that system under the same existing rules. So currently, when a licensed dealer runs a background check, you fill out a form that's called a 4473, and the dealer uses that form to run the background check through the federal database.
Correct.
If you pass that background check, you're a law-abiding citizen, it takes 90 seconds, 90% of the time these checks take a minute and a half or less.
Right.
Once that check is completed, if it's successful, the dealer makes a copy of that record, and the government, the FBI, destroys all record of the check in the first place. So there's no centralized database. What you have is over 55,000 dealers all across the country. I mean, and when I say 55,000 dealers, that's more than post offices and McDonald's combined across the country. So, it's widely dispersed. And so you have these dealers keeping records of their individual sales, which is then used by law enforcement in case a gun that the dealer sold shows up at a crime scene. They can kind of trace the chain of custody and try and figure out, how that gun was diverted into criminal hands. But
now, how do you know that
it's not? I just want to make the point that a national registry of guns is actually explicitly forbidden under federal law.
Correct.
1986 rule that was established by legislation explicitly prohibits any federal registry. And the Manchin-Toomey amendment and the Schumer bill that's currently on the floor, I mean, those, outlawed again. So there's pretty explicit prohibition against that.
Yeah, no doubt about it. Well, listen, Steve, we really appreciate the work that you're doing. The organization is called Mayors Against Illegal Guns, and it has the same website, correct?
So our main website is called demandaction.org, and that's our campaign, Demand Action, essentially, calling on Congress to do their job and protect the public safety of their constituents.
Excellent, excellent. Well, Steve, again, thank you very much for your time on the air, and thank you for all the hard work that you're doing trying to make our society more sane and safe.
No, thank you so much for your time.
Okay, thank you. All right, well, there you have it. Steve Barton, my friends, we're going to get back. The Freedom Lines will be opened up. If you want to participate in today's program, give us a shout-out at 1-866-987-THOM. Again, that's 1-866-987-8466.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Broadcasting live from 1480 KPHX, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in right now. We're going to get to the Freedom Lines in a second at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. But before we do that, I want to follow up on the conversation we just had with our guest, who was with the organization Mayors Against Illegal Guns. And today was a big, big victory, I guess, of sorts, in the sense that the Senate was able to muster up enough votes to move forward at least with a debate on the gun issue. And that is a major, major breakthrough. As you know, in this particular Congress, in the Senate, there's been many, many, many filibusters, and practically nothing gets done. The work of the people doesn't get done, is the bottom line, because of the filibustering from Senate Republicans. Well, lo and behold, now in this particular case, practically all the Democrats joined with, it looks, about 16 Republicans, and they voted 68-31 to actually move forward on a procedural measure to begin this consideration for the proposed gun law that now is being sponsored in a bipartisan way by Democrat Joe Manchin from West Virginia and Republican Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania. So this is major, major, major news, because now at least the people are going to get a chance to hear the debate. Now, what happens from here on out is anybody's guess, because there's lots of tricks and little different things that they can do to stop the debate or to slow it down or grind it to a halt, many type of legislative maneuvers, poison pills. I mean, you name it. It's by no means going to be a clean, fair, honest debate. But the bottom line is, at least they got in the door and now they could start the debate process. So let me just tell you kind of what the central measures are. What they're looking at in this particular compromise was extending the existing background check rules to gun sales that are made online and also at gun shows. So that, as I told you yesterday, it's kind of ironic, because we were speaking yesterday about the fact that, look, if there's agreement on a particular piece of the legislation, i.e. expanding background checks, and I told you about the two polls yesterday, one was 87%, one was 97%, in which the people of America actually agree on expanding background checks, well, then let's tackle that first. And that's exactly what it appears that Manchin and Toomey have done. You got a Republican who is Toomey, and you got Manchin who's a Democrat. They're willing to come together and say, at least let's consider this. But nonetheless, we know that there are many conservative Republicans, and in particular, Wayne LaPierre, the NRA, they are staunchly, staunchly against this. And actually, in a letter that the NRA released yesterday evening, they said they were, quote, unequivocally opposed to any of these new gun rules, including the Manchin-Toomey proposal or compromise, if you will. Chief lobbyist Christopher Cox, he's with the NRA, he said, quote, given the importance of these issues, votes on all anti-gun amendments or proposals will be considered in NRA's future candidate evaluations. That sounds like he's trying to threaten, Eric, future candidates, that if anybody happens to agree with any piece of this legislation, that the NRA is going to come at him with fire and brimstone, and when these elections come up, they're not going to support them and do everything to have them defeated.
Got to get rid of the NRA.
Yeah, it's amazing to me how effective, or at least they seem to have a lot of sway over these politicians.
Oh, it's incredible. It's corrupt.
Yeah, it does. It seems very, very strange that you would be succumb to that kind of pressure from just one specific group. Lobbying group, and they can't be funding all of these campaigns to the max. I mean, they might have a few grand or something. I mean, are politicians that sort of bad that they would sell out their soul for just a few grand in a campaign?
Really? You just figured that out?
Unbelievable. Because when you see the actual amounts of money that are donated to these campaigns, I mean, sometimes they're just grossly, you know, very, very high. But sometimes the numbers are so small. I'm like, why would you?
Yeah, why would you let these people tell you what to do?
Right. Talk about
a few thousand dollars.
Exactly. Talk about the tail wagging the dog. But we'll see what happens. Hopefully this will move forward. They'll have some meaningful debate. But as I said, I'm skeptical, and there are a lot of other people who are skeptical as well, including 33 family members who opined on this. 33 family members of the Newton victims, they actually put forward a joint statement. And let me just read you an excerpt from that. They said, quote, the senators who have vowed to filibuster this bill should be ashamed of their attempt to silence efforts to prevent the next American tragedy. Their staunch opposition to sensible gun reform is an affront to the 26 innocent children and educators who were murdered in Newton. So you have 33 family members saying, you know, enough is enough. Stop with the filibustering. Let's have an honest debate. Let's have a vote. And that's what the president has said all along. When the president gave his State of the Union, as he's gone out there and crisscrossed the country, he's been very particular about, look, at least let's have a debate and let's have a vote and let the chips fall where they may. Look, if you can make your case on why you don't want expanded background checks, why you don't want to look at people who have mental illness, if you don't agree with any of those things, then guess what? Get up there on the Senate floor, get onto the House floor, you'll have your time, and state your case. And then let the American people see where you stand on these particular issues, and then vote. I mean, but it seems as though every step along the way, if the Republicans and the conservatives don't agree with you, they don't want a debate. They want to stifle the debate. They want to grind it to the halt. They want to put a filibuster in. And that's not the way our democracy is supposed to work. We're supposed to have a vibrant discussion about these issues. That's what the founding fathers envisioned. I mean, Eric, sometimes I wish we would do it the way they do in England, in the parliament. I mean, you ever see how they stand up and they shout at each other? They get angry, but it's very entertaining too, actually. But at least the people are engaged in debate in the British parliament. And you don't get that here. Everything here in America, a lot of it's posturing, a lot of it's fabricated, it's very sanitized and watered down, and it's just, again, I don't think that's in the spirit of what America is all about. I don't think that's in the spirit of our democracy. It's not what the founding fathers envisioned when they created this great democracy. We have devolved rather than evolved, but who knows? You always have to keep hope alive. Look, when we get back, we'll be taking your calls. 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, this is Dr. Mike Newcomb, sitting in for Tom Hartman. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. We're going to get right to the Freedom Lines right now as we speak. First up in the queue is Jason on the line from Santa Cruz, California. Jason, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm doing well. So what's on your mind with respect to the gun regulations and the Senate taking up this issue?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm absolutely appalled. I think any infringement on our Second Amendment rights is wrong and should absolutely be, the people should stand up and say enough. Enough is enough is enough. There's something like 50,000 gun laws on the books already, many of which are redundant and absolutely infringe on our rights. And having a universal gun check is just a step too far. The federal government, actually Eric Holder, who was involved in Fast and Furious, has no problems with letting thousands of guns go into Mexico, which kill tens of thousands of people. He's not accountable for that, yet he wants law-abiding citizens to be accountable and be registered for buying a firearm. It's ridiculous, and it needs to stop.
Let me ask you a question before you go forward. What from your perspective, define to me what your right is as a gun. I assume you're a gun owner, correct?
Correct.
Yeah, so just
I've been shooting since I was 6 years old. I've had, my hunter safety courses. I was taught by my father how to safely handle a gun since I was a child. And, never once has there ever been an issue.
No. I understand that. It sounds like you're a responsible gun owner. But my question to you is, what do you, in your own words, what does it mean to have that right? How, in other words, tell me what it means. Because it sounds like you're against the expansion of background checks and things like that. So what do you, in your own words, consider it that right?
It is the right of me as a human being with God-given rights to defend myself against attack. And that's 'foreign and domestic, obviously. Yeah, the Second Amendment was not put there for hunting, okay? And that's a big fallacy. People say, well, what do you need an AR-15 to hunt deer with? And it's like, you know what? No, I don't need an AR-15 to hunt deer with, even though you can. What I need an AR-15 to do is to defend myself and my family. It is a very efficient weapon to defend yourself with.
Okay, so let me ask you this, because we got to... we got a lot of callers, and I do appreciate your perspective. So are you saying then that basically this is a God-given right, not only a constitutional right, but a God-given right, and that nobody should ask any questions? You should be able to purchase whatever gun you want. Anyone should do that, regardless if you're a criminal or mentally ill or whatnot, that anybody and everybody should get a gun. It's nobody's business, and leave well enough alone. Is that kind of your stance on this?
For the most part, you know, and like what they're doing with veterans right now, okay, they've stated that veterans are the number one terrorist, the domestic terrorist threat in the United States, and veterans are getting letters in the mail right now asking them to come in to be evaluated for mental illness, and if they say, they're asked, hey, are you sad that you got your leg blown off? And if they say, yeah, I'm sad that you got your leg, you know, that I got my leg blown off, I'm kind of depressed about that. And then they say, oh, got to have your guns.
Yeah, well, I don't know if it's, I think you're oversimplifying all that. But listen, I appreciate the call, Jason. I understand what you're saying, but I don't think that is the purpose of the veterans doing some type of screening. First and foremost, I can tell you, as a doctor, I've worked in the veteran system. There is a lot of what we call post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, and obviously that's exacerbated when you are in a combat-type situation, when you not only have your own leg blown off, but when you've seen, you know, other of your comrades, other of your fellow soldiers, seeing their heads blown off or their body parts blown off. That is a very traumatic thing for individuals, and oftentimes people don't get the appropriate mental health care that they need when they return, and they have to deal with it on their own. And oftentimes, many veterans who are in such a situation become depressed, they become suicidal, they become homicidal. So it's not that people are trying to come out there and take away veterans' guns, but on the contrary, they're trying to identify people who really need some mental health services. And that, I think, is a good thing. And if you look at those returning veterans, Jason, I'm sure if they do have PTSD or if they do have profound depression or they are suicidal, then a gun is only going that's not the kind of person that you necessarily want to have a gun given that particular state of mind, and I think that's an appropriate thing to do. In any case, let's get back to the Freedom Lines right now because they are packed and many people want to weigh in with their thoughts on this. So let's just go next to Elijah on the line, and he is from San Saba, Texas, and he wants to speak on the gun issue as well. Many people want to speak on the gun issue, so I'm going to get to everybody here. Elijah, you're live on the Tom Hartman program.
Yes, I am. I'll tell you what, Dr. Mike, the way I see this is the Republicans are stirring up this stink on this gun control when they could care less if you got a gun or not. You know, they say it's a constitutional right that everyone here in this country should have a weapon. Well, I'm 71 years old, and I haven't got a weapon. I don't need one.
Right.
You know, and they stir up one stink after another just to get people all upset, and then they get your focus off of what they're really up to.
Right.
What they really want is there's three things that the Republican Party wants.
Mm-hmm.
And that is Medicare, Social Security.
Yeah, they want them privatized, right?
You bet. And the post office.
Right, right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. No, you're right. They basically are beholden to their private corporate lobbyists and anything that if you could take a big segment of our economy like healthcare, okay, and if you look at healthcare is the biggest segment of our economy for this country. 15 to 16% of every dollar in this country is spent on healthcare. Medicare itself spends roughly between $2.5 to $3 trillion every year on healthcare. So you are 100% right, Elijah. What they are trying to do is get access to that $2 to $3 trillion revenue stream, take it out of the hands of the government, put it into the pockets of the private sector, and the private sector wants all that money in their pockets, and they don't want to provide necessarily the services that all of the Medicare recipients are getting right now. And you're exactly correct with Social Security. They want to take that money that's stable and secure and is providing benefits to people and put it into a casino, which is known as the modern day stock market. I mean, make no question about it. The modern day stock market is nothing but a casino. And we saw what happened when you come up with all these crazy arcane, you know, derivatives and credit default swaps and this and that. And when they were unregulated, just like they want the gun industry to be unregulated, when you leave things unregulated, Elijah, the cat's away, the mice will play. I don't know if you ever heard that statement, but that's exactly what they want. They don't want the cat around. They want to be mice just roaming free to get their cheese whenever they want. And unfortunately, that's not the way the world, you know, is supposed to work. And people are putting up a fierce stance against it. So, Elijah, thanks for calling in from San Saba, Texas. We appreciate it. Where is San Saba, actually?
Oh, well, let's see. It's about 125-30 miles northwest of Austin.
Northwest of Austin. Okay, excellent. All right, well, listen, we appreciate you listening on Free Speech TV, and you have a great day.
You too.
Bye-bye now. Bye-bye. Okay, all right, listen, let's see who we got on next in the queue. Let's go to... Let's say George. Let's go to George on the line from Sirius XM. He's listening on Sirius XM, and he's from Minnesota. So welcome, George.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing well. I'm doing well. What's on your mind today?
Well, a couple of things. One, when you were talking with your guest earlier, you said that it's illegal for the federal government to have a registry as though it's some kind of an ironclad guarantee. And, you know, I think you know that all some Congress has to do is pass a new law, and all of a sudden we can have a gun registry.
Mm-hmm.
It's that simple.
Let me ask you this, George. What is the argument against the gun registry, though? I mean, I kind of vacillate on this.
I'm not arguing for or against that. I'm just pointing that out that's not some kind of an ironclad registry, and I don't want to get sidetracked from my other points. Which is, I've seen the way liberals operate in the past with other things, particularly like health care. No matter how big government gets, no matter how little our freedom gets, any problems are blamed on the residual freedom that we have, and it becomes a rationale for more government.
Right.
You know, we passed this expanded background thing here, and there's, you know, the next mass shooting, the liberals are going to say, oh, well, we didn't do enough. We're going to have to do more. And you're just going to have to sacrifice more of your freedoms and more of your rights, and government's going to have to get bigger, and that just keeps happening and happening. I mean, you're a doctor. You've seen that happen in healthcare.
I'm actually happy.
No matter how big a footprint government gets in healthcare, whatever problems there are blamed on the smaller and diminishing residue of freedom that we have in the healthcare industry, and that becomes a rationale for expanding government's role.
All right. Well, listen, George, I got to get going because I got a break, but I'm going to respond to your comment because I disagree with you about government's role in healthcare. Actually, I'm very happy that government has stepped into the healthcare sector because the private sector, quite frankly, the way that it was going was ruining healthcare and ruining the practice of medicine. And I'll give you my comments when I get back. So I appreciate the call. Thank you. All right, that's George from Sirius, listening on Sirius from Minnesota, and we'll be back with your calls in a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Mike Newcomb, broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, sitting in for Tom Hartman. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. I want to take issue with what George said about liberals and the fact that liberals are always trying to limit someone's freedoms and take away their freedoms and chisel away little by little by little. And he gave the example of healthcare. And I have to say, George, I 100% disagree with you with respect to the healthcare issue. Being a practicing physician for over, you know, 20 years now, that is simply not true. The fact of the matter is government-run healthcare, at least from my perspective, runs much more efficiently. It's much more decentralized. It's much more deregulated, if you will. It gives the provider, me, the physician, the freedom to practice medicine the way that I choose versus the private-run sector is an absolute nightmare to navigate through. And you can ask anybody out there who has private health insurance the kind of loophole, the hoops that they have to jump through just to get basic health care. And I've spoken about this extensively both on this program and on my own local program here. But the bottom line is that if it's a private health insurance, you have to get authorization. You have to get pre-approved. You have to wait, you know, days, sometimes weeks before a treatment that a doctor orders for you could even be considered and approved and get done. It's just an incredible, incredible morass. You want to talk about big government, I'm going to talk to you about big corporations. These big corporations are definitely not fine-tuned and are not lean, mean fighting machines when it comes to efficiency and productivity. They do whatever they can in their power to put up as many roadblocks for you to access your private health care benefits versus the government does the absolute opposite. They give you a benefit. It's defined. They don't try to go back and say, look, we're not going to do this for you or change the rules of the game midway. This is what happens in the private sector. And quite frankly, when you talk, George, about freedom and liberty, everywhere I turn, everywhere I look, it's the Republicans and the conservatives in this country who are trying to limit liberty and freedom every step of the way. I mean, we've been talking about it for the last, you know, 2 weeks that I've been sitting on this program. We're talking about marriage equality. You want to talk about marriage equality? Who are the people out there who are trying to say, no, you're not equal. You're not equal to everybody else. We want to limit your freedoms. We don't want to give you the opportunity to love somebody and to be out there in the open and have the same access to rights that every other heterosexual couple does. That's your Republican Party. That's the conservatives doing this. Look, later on in the show, I'm going to talk to you about in Missouri. There was a couple that were married for 5 years, and this one guy, his partner, was in the hospital, and I'll give you all the details, but the long and short of it was he was in the hospital, in the room, he was power of attorney for his partner, and then one of the family members who had absolutely nothing to do with this guy's care, did not have power of attorney, had no sort of legal power, told the partner to leave the room. And the partner said, no, I'm not going to leave the room. It's just my husband. I'm married. We have a civil union, and I have power of attorney, a legal document that I'm supposed to represent this man, that this person whom I love. And the long and short of it was the hospital calls in security. Security comes in, and the end result was they arrested this guy. They put him in cuffs, arrested him, and took him out of the hospital. So you want to talk about limiting freedom? Limiting liberties? This is what your people are doing. When a loved one is sick in the hospital and they're married and committed in a monogamous relationship, and this guy's getting handcuffed because some bigot, some family bigoted member doesn't like the fact that he's gay and he's married to the family member and tells him to get out of the room, that's what you call liberty and freedom? That's what you want to do, George. You want to codify in the law institutionalized discrimination. And it's not just for marriage equality that we're talking about. Look at women, how women are discriminated against. You want to talk about limiting freedom and liberty? We had a very robust discussion yesterday about rape, and that if a woman is raped, that you're saying that government should be used to tell that woman she has to have that baby. Isn't it ironic, George, that you say the liberals are the ones who use government to expand government, and limit liberties and freedoms? But every step away, the evidence, the hard objective evidence, everywhere you look, it's your people who are doing this systemically, not isolated instances. This is what they're doing systemically. Sorry, Eric, let me get a little bit of water here. Yeah, I'm getting a little worked up here.
I brought you your lunch, too.
I got my lunch next to me there. So make no bones about it. When you hear conservatives talk about liberals trying to expand government and limit liberties and freedoms, it is the absolute opposite. They are not conservatives. They are con artists. We see it here in Arizona. We had a bill that was passed, signed into law by our Governor John Brewer. Senate bill was a 1070 that basically said that if a police officer or a law enforcement officer is just riding around in the street and he sees somebody, he or she sees somebody that they think is not here illegally.
Not here legally, you mean?
Or not here legally, right. That they can go and arrest that person or detain them and ask them for their papers to prove that they're citizens.
For no reason.
Yeah, they talk about racial profiling. Again, this is your party. This is your ideological movement limiting people's liberties and freedom, profiling. Well, that guy, he looks brown, or he looks a little dark, or he might be from Mexico. And if he's from Mexico, then he's clearly not a citizen from here, the United States. So let me go and just cuff that guy, or let me go detain that guy. That's limiting somebody's freedom, isn't it, George? Putting him in cuffs at the point of a gun and saying, prove to me that you're a citizen, and your people here in Arizona, the state legislators, all Republicans, all conservatives, passing bills like that. And then having a governor, Republican conservative governor, signing that into law. Now, thank God we do have a system of democracy, a system of checks and balances. And after this went under judicial review, George, guess what? Many of the appellate judges are now saying at the federal level, this is unconstitutional, George. Your little brethren, your little cronies down there at the state capitol here in Arizona, guess what? You can't just on a hunch say somebody's here illegally because they happen to look different than you, George. But you see who's using government, George, for their own agenda, to limit, to curtail, to deny liberty and freedom? It's your own people, George. It's your own people. Take a hard look, a long, hard look in the mirror, and you'll see the truth. Back in a moment.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back, my friends. Hour number two here. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. We have a special guest on the line. Her name is Vicki Szabo, and she is the director of the Work and Family Programs National Partnership for Women and Families. And today we're going to be talking about the GOP's war on workers and chipping away at workers' rights. You just heard George earlier talking about how liberals want to limit freedoms and people's liberties. Well, this is obviously a case here, and that's what we're going to talk to Vicki about. So, Vicki, welcome to the table here.
Thanks, Dr. Mike. It's so great to be with you.
It's great to be here. So give us a little backdrop on what's happening. I know Eric Cantor's talking about, quote-unquote, making life work, his new agenda, and the House Resolution 1406, the Working Families Flexibility Act. Tell us what's really underneath the onion skin layers there.
That's a great way to put it. Well, this bill, the so-called and we think misnamed Working Families Flexibility Act of 2013, is actually quite a well-worn proposal. It's something that has been brought up by Republicans again and again. In fact, the identical version of this bill passed the House of Representatives in 1997. Fortunately, it was never acted on by the Senate. It was debated again in 2003, and again, it didn't pass in 2003. It didn't even come to a vote. But essentially what this bill would do is strip away the 75-year-old protection that we have in the Fair Labor Standards Act that requires employers to provide time-and-a-half compensation to employees for any hours worked over 40 in a week.
Right.
And so what this bill would do is take away that basic protection and instead permit employers to give employees, quote-unquote, the choice to accept comp time in lieu of overtime payments, essentially taking pay out of people's wallets while giving them perhaps the false promise of time off at some later date.
So to explain that in a little more detail, so say, for instance, I work 50 hours and I got 10 hours of overtime that I should get paid time and a half for that. So what is Cantor proposing? So he's saying that it's that an employer can say, rather than me actually pay you that time and a half that you're owed, I'm going to allow you to take some time off and spend time with your family and not pay you that money?
That's right. It's exactly right. So what this law would allow under your situation is that 10 hours of overtime pay that you would get, which would be at your time and a half rate, could be provided to you instead at 15 hours, time and a half hours of overtime of comp time at some time in the future. It alleges that there would be a voluntary agreement between employers and employees on this point. But in reality, we all know that the power dynamics in the workplace are far from uneven, or far from even, particularly among non-unionized workers. And the other really important piece is that for that 15 hours, you would need your employer's permission to take the time off. They could essentially veto a request for time that you wanted at some point in the future. So say you wanted to use that 15 hours to help your brother through surgery, and you needed that time off at a specific time. Well, your employer could say that that time off would unduly disrupt the employer's business operations and could deny your time off. So you would have worked the time in it. You would have worked overtime, but you wouldn't be able to take the time when you needed it.
That doesn't sound too flexible to me.
No, it's actually what this does is take money out of people's wallets. It probably provides incentives for employers actually to have people work more overtime hours because it's cheaper to provide comp time than overtime, and it wouldn't leave you with the time that you'd earned when you need it.
Wow. Now, do you see this getting any headway in the House, or what are your thoughts on that?
Well, you know, Mr. Cantor has said that this is one of his priorities. We understand that it'll be marked up in the full Education and Workforce Committee next week, and that it's supposed to hit the floor of the House of Representatives two weeks hence. So I do think it will move. I do hope that lawmakers on both sides of the aisle see the smoke and mirrors aspect of this proposal and instead consider some other alternatives that really would help working families.
Such as? Give us some examples of those.
So, for example, the right to take paid sick time, the right to earn paid sick time. This is a proposal called the Healthy Families Act. It continues to gain traction in Congress. It's been sponsored for the last several years by Rosa DeLauro in the House of Representatives and Tom Harkin in the Senate. It would allow all employees in businesses with 15 or more workers to earn paid sick time that they could use for themselves or to take care of a family member.
So that would be in addition to vacation time, too.
That would be in addition to vacation time that they might earn.
Okay, that sounds reasonable.
40% of private sector workers don't have any paid sick time. And what Mr. Cantor is saying is, and Ms. Roby is saying, is that this comp time that you have earned through your hard work could be used for that purpose, but actually because of the employer's ability to veto that time off and the requirement that employee provide notice, this actually is not any kind of substitute for guaranteed paid sick time.
No. What if there was an amendment to that that said, hey, you know what, if I've earned this and I have the credit and I've worked and done my time, say 10, 15 hours, and that when I do need that time off, like you said, if you want to help somebody who's going through surgery, you got to be there then. You can't, you know, say, well, you know, Mother, may I? I mean, what if there was something in that that said, yes, anytime you want to exercise that, then you can do that, and they don't have a veto right to that?
Well, it might be a step in the right direction, but it doesn't address the underlying need that people who are not working overtime also have. To take a sick day, to care for a sick loved
one, to care for
a new baby. And so what we would much rather see are protections that apply to workers, whether they're working overtime, whether they're just working full-time, or whether they're working part-time.
Right. So what you're saying, because with the Family Medical Leave Act, you can take time off, but that's uncompensated time.
That's right, and that's a big barrier. And so what working families really need is a national paid family and medical leave insurance program for those more serious illnesses, to care for loved ones with more serious illnesses, and to care for a new child. You know, we're one of very few countries in the world that don't provide paid maternity leave. We're one of only a slightly larger group that doesn't provide paid paternity leave, and we're certainly one of, you know, just a handful of nations that don't have paid sick leave.
And it's interesting because I've looked at some of those statistics in the past, Vicki, and it seems as though those nations that provide all of those types of benefits that you mentioned are oftentimes the top 5 or 10 happiest countries when they look at happiness indexes across the world.
That's right. They're happy. They're also productive. You know, we are the only country in the in the 22 industrialized nations, top industrialized nations, that don't provide these benefits.
No, that is very, very sad. Let me ask you one other quick question, too, because I know you work with the National Partnership for Women and Families. Where are we with the women pay equity? Are we making any progress with that?
Well, you know, I mean, that was a huge issue in this election. Equal pay, fair pay, is something that voters across the board believe should be the case. And that's true, by the way, for paid sick days and paid leave. All of these policies are enormously popular across party lines because Democrats and Republicans out in the real world voters, know that for families to be economically secure and for loved ones to be able to care for one another, you need to have economic security and you need to have the time to care.
No doubt about it, because this is statistics that I've looked at, that women get paid you know, 75, 77 cents per dollar that men get. So that's like a 23% pay cut just for being a woman.
That's exactly right. And for women of color, it's even worse. So this is a significant problem. And, you know, the comp time proposal would actually only make this worse because, you know, if a woman is earning 77% of what a man would be earning and then is asked to give up overtime pay, that's a significant financial hit on top of another significant financial barrier.
And not to be compensated during your maternity leave either.
Oh, yeah, exactly right. I mean, we are lacking some basic policies in this country that really would provide economic security, job security, and you know, provide for the well-being of families. And the comp time proposal is not it. It kind of sets up this very false and dangerous dichotomy between time and money when actually working families urgently need both.
No doubt about it. Well, listen, Vicki, thank you for your time on the air today. The website is nationalpartnership.org, and enjoyed speaking with you.
Thank you, Mike. I've enjoyed speaking with you, too.
Okay, bye-bye now. All right, we'll be back with more of the Tom Hartman Program in a moment.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Up next, Congressman Keith Ellison. Okay, welcome back to the Tom Hartman Program. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom today. And tomorrow we have a special guest on the line. He is Congressman Keith Ellison, a Democrat from Minnesota's 5th Congressional District. And let's get to our esteemed guest. Congressman, welcome to the program.
Keith here. How's it going?
Good to hear from you. Good to hear from you. Well, listen, a lot of controversy right now about the president's proposed budget, and in particular, these chain CPI and potential cuts to Social Security. Let's start from there, Congressman, and tell us kind of what are your thoughts and what are you seeing out there on the floor?
Well, you know, my thoughts are that chain CPI is a very bad idea. It's not an accurate reflection of inflation for seniors. In fact, it undercounts inflation for seniors, and therefore, if applied, would be a benefit cut to seniors. But not only seniors, also people who get survivor benefits, people who are on disability benefits, people, veterans. It could also lead to, a bracket creep with regard to taxation. So it's a bad thing. We're standing up against it. We're fighting it. And, you know, I feel that we're gonna prevail on this thing. You know, I will say this, though. I've been a little worried that some progressives have started to attack Obama personally, and I don't think that's the right thing to do. My opinion is that, look, you know, this was a right-wing proposal. He mistakenly, in my opinion, put it in his proposal as some sort of a olive branch to them, which they then now you even hear the Republicans attacking him for having this in their budget. I think it's bad because I don't want to hurt the Democratic brand. I mean, the Congress had nothing to do with this. It's important to know that. And many of us in Congress are now, you know, even though I've been fighting this thing for months and months and months, even though, Democrats in Congress have pretty much, we had 107 people on a letter saying they're against it, and many more would vote against it. Now, you know, I just don't want our people to be demoralized and think that, you know, this thing is something that should cause them to not fight back and stand up for middle class and seniors. I mean, this is no time to get demoralized. This is the time to push back on this chain CPI thing, stand together, and remember that the one way to make sure that seniors have everything that they need and make sure we stand up for our earned benefit program and social insurance is to stick together. So I guess
I agree with you. Look, and I don't think it's any time to disparage the president or cast aspersion upon him. Look, he's working hard, and he's got a very intransigent Congress there.
Yeah.
Very difficult to try to find some compromise. So I think he's kind of doing like what you had alluded to, you know, extending the hand if you'll unclench your fist kind of a thing, and let's see where we can go from that. But, you know, these things are always open for discussion. It's not a done deal. And I think, like you said, it's not a time to get demoralized, but it's a time to get mobilized. And, you know, that's how we have our voices heard in this. democracy. Right. So let me ask you this, Congressman, too, because I know we're hearing a lot about the Social Security and the potential cuts with this chain CPI, but what are you also hearing on the Medicare side, too? And we're starting to hear things bubble up that, you know, there might be some, you know, decrease in benefits from Medicare, or might be proposed cuts to the Medicare benefit. Are you actually seeing any of that in the proposed budget?
Yeah, that's certainly part of the discussion. I mean, Social Security has taken on most of the conversation, but there are some proposed Medicare cuts in that budget, and the budget is not going to be passed, but we're going to make sure it's not going to be passed because we're going to stand up against it. The Progressive Caucus is against any cuts to Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid to beneficiaries. Now, that's not to say we're not for improving the program and strengthening the program all on their own, but in the fight, in the context of the general debate on budget, you know, these programs, I mean, Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid shouldn't be in that conversation. If you want to mess with those programs and the conversations about how to strengthen them and lengthen them, then let's have an independent dialogue around that and include things like raising the cap and things like, lowering medical inflation, which has been out of control, but which, because of the Affordable Care Act, we're beginning to get in some control. You know, if we talk about those, if we talk about the program on their own weight, it makes sense to do. But once you start saying we're going to have this conversation as we discuss closing loopholes for Chevron, Exxon, and BP, then it kind of looks like, okay, if poor people take a little less, then rich people might lose their and corporations might lose their loophole. It's just no equivalency. You know,
no, absolutely, it's a false equivalency there.
It should be separate dialogue.
Let me ask you about the Medicare side, though, because I am a physician. I'm a geriatric physician practicing here in Phoenix, Arizona. And one of the things that I did like about Obama's stance, particularly when he was running for reelection, was to create $700 billion worth of savings in Medicare, not taking away people's benefits, but actually, mm-hmm. like you said, strengthening the program by maybe reducing reimbursement to Medicare Advantage plans that get paid inflated reimbursements but are not necessarily providing any more services. Things like allowing the government to negotiate with pharmaceutical companies,
what we should be doing.
Right. So how do we steer the conversation towards those kind of issues versus, like you said, trying to, you know, decrease benefits from Social Security or Medicare beneficiaries?
Well, we just have to keep on talking about it. We just have to raise the issue and be robust in terms of presenting these issues as often as we can. We just have to continue to talk about it. A lot of people don't even really know that while the VA can negotiate drug prices, that under the Republican bill of 2003, Medicare Part D, we basically have to pay what they tell us to pay, right?
Right.
So we can't even get a quantity discount by negotiation, and so this is a ridiculous policy, and we should just get rid of it.
Right.
And so, you know, this is something that we could maybe save over the course of 10 years, perhaps $160 billion.
Wow.
I mean, it's a tremendous amount of money. And yet, we've set up this giveaway program back in 2003, and it's time for real reform to move forward. So I definitely think that we're at a moment now when if people want to talk about reforming Medicare and saving money in Medicare, then we absolutely got to be talking about the negotiation.
Absolutely. Well, listen, Congressman, thank you for your time on the air. Hey, and give our best regards to one of our local freshmen, Congresswoman Kyrsten Sinema. She's give her our best. Thanks a lot, Congressman. Okay, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Back in a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Back with your calls on the Freedom Lines in a moment. Okay, welcome back. Let's get to the Freedom Lines at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. First up in the queue, let's go to Corky on the line from Rochester, New York, listening on Free Speech TV. Corky, welcome to the table.
Oh, doctor. Yeah, I want to know where that Carolyn Maloney's bill is for the insurance policy on firearms liability.
I'm not quite familiar with that. What's the legislation that you're referencing?
She's got legislation in the works for requiring liability insurance on firearms. When you buy a gun,
right,
have a liability policy on it.
Huh.
Now, I don't see where that interferes with the Second Amendment. But my First Amendment right guarantees me a life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness. Where did your Second Amendment right begin?
Right. So, yeah. Interesting.
So why do I have to fear the irresponsibility of some neighbor who has an AR-15 that is kicking his hands on? Now, if you put insurance policy requirements on each firearm, mm-hmm. that's going to limit the number of firearms a person can afford, like
sure.
Lance's mother. If she had to have a liability policy on each firearm, I don't know if she could afford all the ones she had. And besides that, the private sector, they all say, can do a better job at background checks. Because if the insurance companies are going to be liable mm-hmm. for the weapon they're insuring, they're going to be much more thorough in who's in the home, the condition of the people in the home, and the amount of money it's going to cost them if somebody's irresponsible with that firearm.
Yeah, I hear what you're saying. I just don't see that having a snowball's chance in hell of getting through this particular Congress. I mean, it's enough that they're requiring background checks, but what you're basically saying is that every gun owner would have to go out there and get an insurance policy to be an owner of that gun, and I don't see that happening at all.
But they do it cars. I mean, they forced me to have an insurance policy on my car.
I know. I understand. I understand what you're saying.
Yeah.
I don't think that proposal is going to go anywhere.
It has anything to do with the Second Amendment. Mm. All we're doing as citizens is saying you must be responsible with the things you buy.
Right, and get a policy on it. All right, listen, Corky, I appreciate your time. Let me get to the other callers. Thanks for calling in today.
All right.
Okay, there you have it. It's Tom's idea to do the insurance on a thing. I mean, I don't know much about that particular issue, to be honest with you, but I just don't see it happening. I mean, even though it might be a proposal that's appealing to some people, in this environment where they're just trying to get through a background check, I can't imagine them putting a liability policy out there. And they're going to say it's a tax and, you know, now it's supposed to be a right and we shouldn't have to pay, you know, to exercise a right. It's, you know, some people will say, and you know what, you could even make somewhat of an argument for this because isn't it a right to vote, correct?
Yes.
And if it's a right to vote, part of what we were saying is that by all these states, these conservative states, trying to require specific voter ID and this and that, which would be a cost to somebody, right? If you had to get a specific identification, then you have to go out there and purchase that identification. And in essence, that becomes a poll tax because what's supposed to be a right, you shouldn't have to pay for a right. So if you have a right to, say, own a gun, and that's enshrined in the Second Amendment, let's just say for the sake of argument, that's what it means, although I happen to disagree somewhat on what that means. But if that's a right, then you're now putting a tax on somebody's right. Wouldn't you agree?
Yes.
Yeah.
I have my mouth full.
You have your mouth. Eric is eating right now. All right. Any case, let's get back to the Freedom Lines. Let's go next to John on the line from Sirius. He's calling, and he's in New York City. John, what's on your mind today?
How you doing, Doctor?
Good.
I have an idea. Why don't you guys just do this? Why don't you just don't even pay attention to the Constitution? Just when you look at it, read it, and just do whatever you want. Because that's what it seems like.
Like the Republicans.
Right?
Like
what you're doing. I didn't say anything about Republicans. I'm not talking about parties. Don't divert. Let's talk about the issues. Why don't we just ignore the Constitution?
What are we missing on the Constitution?
What do you mean? What are you missing on the Constitution? You have every single policy coming out. I don't care. I'm not talking about parties. I'm talking about what's going on. Let's forget about Republicans and Democrats.
All right, that's fine.
The unemployment rate is going through the roof. It's almost 10% because people have dropped out the workforce.
It's 7.7%. Again.
Wait, hold up. You have to, it's okay to pull the race car and say, oh, if you're brown, you said before, you get pulled over, it's good for him to get detained. But it's not okay if I get pulled over, I'm white. It's all right then, because I'm white. It's every single angle. And no one's going to be, if we turn this world upside down and turn it into the modern day France, no one will be happy. It just seems like.
I like France. France is a lot of fun. I went there for my honeymoon.
Why don't you move there?
Well, actually, I might actually get some property out there. I'm thinking about it. I like both countries.
Good. That's good. You should. Well, why? It just seems like we're turning into a. If you don't think it, if you're golfing, you say the word socialism these days, everyone gets upset. I respect that you're a doctor. You're good that you help humans. But as far as this, you say the Obamacare law is good. Why does everyone say? Why does everyone I speak to? I'm a friend of the dentist. It's horrible. But you find good in it. Why? Is it because you look at things half glass, half full, or half? What is it? I think you
need to expand your circle of friends, because most of the people that I talk to actually, you know, do find some benefit in it and like the program. Look, I have a lot of colleagues in the healthcare world who don't like it, but the ones who don't like it, quite frankly, John, are the ones who are ignorant to the actual policies itself and what it does to make the healthcare system better. What's that?
I said, if you don't like it, where if you don't, if someone
no, I said the people. I didn't say that. I didn't say you're ignorant. I said the people that I know that I speak to, they are ignorant in the sense that they say, "Oh, I don't like Obama. I don't like Obamacare, and it's socialism, and it's, you know, government-run healthcare," and they're talking out of their you know what because they haven't read the legislation, they don't understand it. And when I say ignorant, I don't mean that in a disparaging way. I just what ignorant means, not knowing. It's from the Latin ignoscere, you don't know. So that's the problem: is that people need to get educated, need to read what the policy says, and then discuss it. But
you think the country's going in the right direction? Honestly, you think the country's really? You think that right now we're in the right direction? You think we're going fiscally, as far as social values? You think we're all going? And I'm like, listen, let's not. Don't hang on gay rights. I don't care whether you want to get gay. I'm not.
Well,
I didn't mean that.
I would say this, John. I would say, you know, there are certain things that are going on in this country that are in the right direction, and there are certain things that are in the wrong direction, and that's, you know, part and parcel of what you have when you have a democracy. Things move at a very slow, sluggish pace, but hopefully as long as that arc of justice is bending in the right way, as long as we are approaching liberty and freedom and the values that our founding fathers had delineated in the Constitution and the Declaration of Independence, you know, it's a tough experiment, democracy. It's never easy, but you know what? I do have faith in America, John. You know, I have faith in our country. I mean, I see you're from New York City. I did my days at NYU there down in Greenwich Village, and you know, a lot of things have changed. You know, when I go to New York now, I don't see those World Trade Centers, you know, that I used to see when I would see the arch over there, you know, the French arch, if you will, the Arc de Triomphe in Washington Square Park. It's very sad. It's very sad when you see things like that. But, you know, are things perfect in this country? No. But is this the best country in the world as far as I'm concerned? Absolutely, it is. There is no other place that I would rather want to say, this is my country, this is the country that I love, and, you know, and France is not so bad either, brother. You got to check out France. It's a lot of fun in Paris.
You should be a politician.
All right. I'll talk to you later.
See you later. Goodbye.
There you have it. It's John calling in from Sirius, and he's there in New York City. But look, he brings up some valid points in the sense that, you know, times are a-changing. And times when they change, people, you know, have different points of view on what should change and what shouldn't change. But never forget, this still is the best country in the world. I mean, I honestly believe that. We are the best country in the world. And when you look at our freedoms and you look at our liberties, you look at the founding fathers, you know, even if you go back to the early days, you know, we were all created equal. But even early on, there still was slavery. Women couldn't vote. So this is a great experiment in democracy. And sometimes democracy takes time and you hit bumps in a row. Not only do you hit bumps in a row, we've had a civil war, for crying out loud. We've had, you know, different geographic regions of this country literally go to war with one another and have hundreds of thousands of millions of people die at the hand of death and destruction. But again, you have to have faith in who we are and what our core fundamental principles are. And I think that's kind of what John was trying to get at. You know, take away the political parties. Forget about Democrat. Forget about Republican. And in that sense, I agree with him. In that sense, I agree that there are certain things that are universal rights. We were just talking about rights. And those are the things that should be held sacrosanct. And as I'll tell you, John, too, when I go around, if I were to be a politician, right, I wouldn't say to somebody, are you a Democrat? Are you a Republican? Are you a conservative? Are you liberal? I would look at them as a human being, as a fellow American, right? When you cut somebody open and you look inside somebody, John, you know, I can't tell looking at your colon if you're, you know, a Democrat. I can't tell if you're conservative. I can't tell if you're an atheist. I can't tell if you're a devout believer. As far as I'm concerned, as a doctor, we're all the same. We're all the same. Either God made us the same, somebody made us the same, evolution made us the same. The bottom line is we are all the same. When you take away skin color, you take away designations of party or race or color or creed, fundamentally, we are all the same. And that's the beauty of America, is that America cherishes those values, those ideas that, you know, we the people, in order to form a more perfect union. And that's how we're going to get there. We got to get there as we, not I the individual, in order to form a more perfect me. It is we the people, in order to form a more perfect union.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and we're broadcasting from 1480 KPHX. Okay, welcome back, my friends. The Freedom Lines are packed. We're going to get to you guys in a short bit, but first up, we do have Ellen Ratner on with Talk Radio News Service, so let's get right to Ellen as we speak and find out what's happening in the world at large. Ellen, welcome.
Good. Well, thank you very much. It looks like that Senate bill is going to be debated on the floor. The cloture vote, which is the 60 votes necessary, was 68-31. Begich of Alaska, Pryor of Arkansas, both up for re-election, two Democrats didn't vote for it. 16 Republicans voted for cloture. It looks like they are going to, this is involving the, and there's going to be debate for a couple weeks, it looks like, sales at gun show and the internet will be controlled. They are actually also adding to this bill something on gun trafficking, $40 million to schools. Now, there is a loophole on this, and the loophole has to do with selling it to families. And
hello, Ellen.
Reading hours at the, you know.
Yeah, I think we're losing you there, Ellen. I don't hear her. So what we're going to do is actually I'll have Ellen call back, and she knows the number, and she'll get a better connection there. But let's get right back to the Freedom Lines right now in the interim. So let's go to Darlene from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin, listening on Free Speech TV. Darlene, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. I just have a few very quick comments. Yesterday you had some people calling in about the background checks.
Correct, for the guns.
And they're, you know, of course, against it. But what do they think when you go to get a credit card application or a driver's license or a renewal, or even when you go to the doctor? You have to fill out forms. Isn't that a form of background check?
Correct.
Right. And then the next thing is the lady that was talking about the abortions. I don't know why they, if they think that people aren't going to be having sex and needing birth control because they don't want to fund birth control.
Right. Hey, do me a favor, Darlene. I don't want to hang up on you. Just hold on right now because they do have Ellen Ratner back on the line. And let's get her. I'm sure we have a better connection now. Ellen, are you back there?
I'm usually not on a cell phone, but I am today. Anyway, so there are these two loopholes, and we don't know yet how they're going to address them. They're not being very open about how they are going to address them. That is certainly there. Also,
Ellen, are they going to consider, too, that you're aware of the limits on the magazines in this particular legislation?
They're probably going to be an amendment, and it'll probably go down. So probably it's not going to be in the bill.
Okay.
Immigration reform, another bill, but this is the Gang of Eight. It will not be finished until Monday. Rubio chief of staff actually has been doing various social media on this. I don't know why, because the wording is not done, but apparently there is going to be on immigration no special legal status for people that are always here, already here, some kind of pathway. People will need, however, if you're here, you will not necessarily get ahead of the line. No amnesty in it. However, there will be an application fee, a fine, a clean record. All of that will be necessary.
Okay, so they're making progress with the Gang of Eight.
I'm sorry?
Yes, they're making progress.
Gang of Eight, absolutely. Okay. The North Korea situation, Mr. Clapper, who is the Director of National Intelligence, which is over the CIA, pointed out that in 1968, the North Koreans did a submarine capture in 1976, They killed two Army officers that were cutting down a tree in the demilitarized zone. And he said, as bad as things are, things have been worse with North Korea.
Right. What are your impressions? Do you think this is just a bluff by Kim Jong-un? Or
I think they may launch a missile, but it may be going to those Japanese islands. I don't think they're stupid enough, but you never can tell, to launch a missile right into South Korea.
Wow.
But you never know.
You never know. What else we got happening, Ellen?
Okay. Other things sort of interesting here. The issue about Assad just came up today from the Human Rights Watch.
Mm-hmm.
Since last July, he has killed 4,300 people in airstrikes. They got this information by talking to eyewitnesses on that one. And last but not least today, Jay-Z, you know him. He said that he got permission from Obama in some rap song that he issued today to go to Cuba. And Jay Carney at the White House said, I guess nothing rhymes with Treasury, implying that he would have had to get that information or permission from the Department of Treasury.
Interesting. Well, listen, Ellen, as always, we appreciate your time and thanks for those nuggets of information.
Thank you.
Okay, there you have it. Ellen Ratner with Talk Radio News Service there. The Freedom Lines are open at 1-866-987-THOM. Again, 1-866-987-8466. During the next hour, I believe we are riding bareback, which means in talk radio terminology, we will have no guests. So it's just going to be me, you, and the Freedom Line. So definitely get in the queue if you want to participate. Let me get back to Darlene. Let her finish her thoughts, though, too, because she was holding for some time. Darlene, welcome back.
Hi, thank you. The other thing I was going to mention was the lady talking about the abortions. They don't want to provide birth control. They don't want abortions. But I'm beginning to think that they also don't think that people are going to be having sex and babies. They don't want to help mothers and children either.
Right. You're damned if you do, damned if you don't. They don't want any sex education. They don't want any morning after pill. They don't want any condoms. And they don't want to provide anything afterwards as far as, you know, the woman and support for the child. So, I mean, they don't really seem to be willing to compromise on any aspect of it, Darlene.
Right. And so what's going to happen to all these babies?
Right.
You know,
right. No.
Starving to death or whatever. And then my final comment is listening to some of the news programs last night with my husband watches regular news and I don't. But anyway, they would keep talking about Social Security, Medicare, things like that being entitlements and how the system's going broke. According to Tom, Ronald Reagan started a special taxes for the Social Security Administration for baby boomers. There is like a baby boomers fund. How come they never talk about this? They're making it sound like that we're breaking the system. And I think that people should contact the news people.
And learn a little bit more about that. Listen, we got to run right now. Darlene, thank you for your call today from Chippewa Falls, Wisconsin. We're going to be back at the top of the hour with more of the Tom Hartman program. The number, 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Okay, welcome back to hour number three. Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman. We're going to get right to the Freedom Lines right now. And first up is Bob on the line from Northville, Michigan, Free Speech TV. Bob, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hey, Dr. Mike. I'm a big fan of the show, you and Eric.
Thank you, sir.
I want to respond to some of these people who've been brainwashed by the Republicans and the corporate billionaire media that the government takes our rights away. I used to be one of them, by the way. But, I mean, the government's there to protect our rights. And I know you mentioned a few of these things, but here's a few examples.
Sure.
The government gave women the right to vote. Mm-hmm. The government freed the slaves. I mean, the government cleaned up our rivers and lakes and our air, you know, the Clean Water Act and the Clean Air Act. The government's trying to protect us from being murdered, 11,000 people a year, by criminals and psychos who have guns.
Right.
You know, I mean, the health
child labor laws
here. What's that?
Child labor laws.
Yeah, there
government
you go.
Implemented the exploitation of children.
Yeah. Yeah.
No, I agree with you. I think, you know, like you said, the government to me is supposed to protect your rights, you know, particularly the rights of minorities. And when I say minorities, I don't mean skin color. It's that, you know, it's very easy in a democracy where people outnumber others that they feel as though, oh, we could just vote this in. And because there's more of us than them, then it's constitutional. We have a right to do that. No, that's not the way our democracy is set up. That it's set up that even if you happen to be in the minority, and what I mean by that is being less of, you know, less numbers, you still should have your rights protected if it's a fundamental right. And I agree with you 100%, Bob. I think that's what the government does or supposed to do best. It's supposed to protect our rights and make sure that other people, that when they get into the majorities or pluralities or whatnot, don't use that to exercise their rights more so than somebody else. So I agree with you.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks a lot, Bob. We appreciate that. Let's get back to the Freedom Lines and let's see who's next up in the queue. It looks as though it's going to be Tony, and he's calling in from Kannapolis, North Carolina, listening on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Tony, welcome to the program.
How you doing?
How you doing, sir?
I'm doing pretty good. I called in about the change behind Social Security.
Yes, sir.
I don't know why the American people don't realize there's two ways to change things. That's either the voting box or everybody go to Washington. There's $3 trillion approximately owed to Social Security. The majority of it was taken when Republicans were in office funding wars and different things. If they just put back what they owe with 1.5% interest, like when I owed the IRS, I had to pay them 1.5% interest. $2,100 turned into $2,500. How much would $3 trillion turn into if they would pay interest back on what they've taken from us? This is just the Republicans' way of trying to never pay back what they owe.
No, I agree, Tony, and it's interesting because we had Congressman Keith Ellison on just previously, and he agreed 100% with you about taking Social Security. Excuse me, I got to sneeze here in a second. Sorry about that. There's no sneeze button here. Like, people sneeze. I don't know why you can't
like
do that.
The cough button
on
radio. Is the same.
But anyway, so listen, Tony. So the point is, Congressman Ellison agrees with you. Senator Bernie Sanders, who's actually a regular guest on Tom's program, he also agrees. Let's take Social Security. Let's take Medicare completely off the table. And I think you're seeing a groundswell right now nationwide, Tony, of people who agree with you and feel as though that these programs should definitely not be targeted. And I applaud you for taking that stance. So thanks for calling in from North Carolina today.
Thank you. Y'all have a good day now.
You too. All right, that's Tony there opening up another Freedom Line here live on the Tom Hartman program at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. Tomorrow maybe we'll get to this too, Eric. I still got that story on my mind. Remember about the kids who were denied their lunch?
Yeah, brought tears to my eyes.
I want to do that at some point. If not today, we'll do it tomorrow on the Bring It On Friday version of the Tom Hartman program. But that was absolutely insane. It just keeps weighing on my mind. And I got some audio for that we'll share with the listening audience here in a quick second. But let's get back to some of the callers right now. Next up in the queue will be David, and he's listening on KBCS, and he wants to weigh in with his thoughts about the work week. Welcome, David.
Thank you, Dr. Newcomb. I called because I've thought about this for a long time about, in 1860, Congress lobbied Washington, D.C. for a 40-hour work week for federal employees. And then 150 years, I think it's about time we lobby Washington for a 20-hour work week, which would allow people time to get a higher education, get a second job, spend time with their family or vacation. It really makes sense to me because that way people would have two jobs, which would be security. It would just about wipe out the unemployment rate. It would improve the standard of living for everyone concerned. It just makes sense to me that we go there and amend this 40-hour work week and expand it to the point where people have enough to live on.
Right. You bring up an interesting point because you're correct in the sense that we're always seem to be working, right? One jobs, two jobs. I remember that clip from President Bush when he was out there when the woman says, you know, I work three jobs. I got a disabled son. I'm single, a mother. And he's like, wow.
Yeah, uniquely American.
That's uniquely American. That's not uniquely American. That's not what we want to be the American legacy when it comes to work. We all value hard work. We all value, you know, getting up in the morning, putting your, you know, shoes on, tying your, you know, sneakers or whatever, and then getting out there and putting in, you know, eight or so hours a day to do what you got to do. But the other idea here too is, because I thought about this, and I don't know about 20. 20 might be too short. But also, even if you kept a 40-hour work week, David, and you had a four-day work week versus 5 days, that would still give you 3 full days out of 7 where, like you said, you could spend more time with your family, more time to go out there and get an education, take some courses, whether it's online or at a university or an institution of higher learning. I mean, I agree. We need to have more time available to us. And if you look at other countries, we talked about this earlier in the program when we had the guest on, I think during the second hour. But if you look at these countries like Norway and the Scandinavian countries and Sweden and you know, all those countries up there, they almost always have the highest rating when it comes to happiness. They have these indices that say which countries across the globe are the happiest. And it always seems that the ones that are happiest are the ones, like you said, who have less work days, less work hours, more vacation time, more family time. So I think that's a very interesting insight, David.
Well, Dr. Newcomb, I don't mean to be funny, but I think, if I'm not mistaken, George Jetson only worked 1 hour a day.
See that? And how about his dog, Elroy? What did he do?
Yes, I know, because I prefer to think of that type of life rather than the point where people work themselves to a frazzle.
Or to death.
They have no strength to even battle, you know, the complications of life.
No, I hear you. All right, listen, David, well said, and thank you for calling in today.
Thank you very much. Bye-bye.
All right, thank you. All right, that's David calling in here right now. The Freedom Lines are open. We still got a whole bunch of people on the lines right now. We got Harvey calling in from Berkeley, California. We got Brett from Denver. We got Pennsylvania. We got Illinois, Texas, Missouri, Oregon. Eric, people calling in from all over the world here just to get in on the Tom Hartman program. That's amazing.
And they wait quite a while, too.
And many of them wait quite some time. So we're going to get to all these calls here in a quick second. Let me give you the number if you want to get in the queue at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. Also, what I want to do, too, probably tomorrow, Eric, since it's bringing on Friday, I got some emails from some of the listeners. I don't know how they got my email address, but in any case, well, did you put it out there?
No, I did not.
No, I don't know. They seem to find it. But I got some interesting emails on the abortion debate that we discussed yesterday, and some very interesting perspectives, you know, but both for and against what we had to say. So I want to clarify that when we get an opportunity to read some of those emails online.
Okay.
All right. Sounds like a plan. Okay. Stay with us, my friends. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to the program. First up is Brett on the line from Denver, Colorado, listening on 760 AM. Brett, welcome to the program.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. It's a big fan, long-time listener, first-time caller.
All righty.
I want to jump in. I was listening to the conversation on Social Security. I just wanted to jump in, my two cents there first. And I just want to say, raise the cap. Mm-hmm. The last time the cap was raised by the amazing Ronald Reagan, right?
Correct.
The icon of the Republican Party. He raised it. It hasn't been raised since.
Right. Well, actually, and some studies have indicated, like you said, Brett, that if you were to raise that cap from, you know, around roughly 100 grand is where it is right now, but you raise that cap to another certain level, that you'd be able to increase the revenue stream into the Social Security safety network there and keep it solvent for God knows how long.
Exactly. And you could probably lower the payroll tax rate that it's taken out of for the working class and help the economy that way. It would spur the economy with more money in our pockets.
No, absolutely.
It's absurd.
Absolutely. Now, you wanted to say something about maybe gun control, too, right? What do you?
I have a different take. Obviously I'm for Social Security. Medicare, Medicaid, make it single pay, single payer. I'm a Democrat. I voted for Obama. But gun control along with the Patriot Act, this is what offends me. I feel like my constitutional rights are being backdoored. If it's time for gun control in America, let's have a constitutional amendment. That would heal our country if enough people voted for it. But it's when you feel like you have no voice and they backdoor you with the Patriot Act, with suspension of habeas corpus if they label you a terrorist.
Right.
Or if it's gun control and they take away your rights, even if it's – I'm not a legal mind. The Constitution says it shall not be infringed.
Yeah, but
I read it.
I agree with you with the Patriot Act, because the Patriot Act was way too crazy. I mean, like you said, suspending habeas corpus, the right to, you know, be duly charged and have access to legal representation. I mean, to suspend that is absolutely against everything that we hold sacrosanct and dear as a nation. So that I disagreed with. I agree with you with the illegal wiretapping, just to be able to go out there and deem somebody a terrorist and all of a sudden you're wiretapping their very most private conversations and discussions. That's too much Big Brother for me. But with gun control, I mean, I don't know if I agree. Well, I know I don't agree with you in the sense that that should not be infringed upon, because I don't think anyone's infringing upon anyone's right to own a gun. I think what we're just trying to say is that if you are going to own a gun, we need to make sure that particular citizen is of sound mind and body to carry that responsibility. So you clearly wouldn't want to give somebody a gun if you knew they were a raging lunatic. You wouldn't want to give somebody a gun if you knew, for instance, they had serious mental illness that would preclude them from any type of rational use of that firearm. And you surely wouldn't want to have a gun in the hands of a documented convicted criminal who's actually even used guns to either kill or harm people in the past. I mean, that's not really infringing on your right.
Well, okay. I've been a victim of gun violence. When I was a young man, a young boy, my mom was murdered by my stepfather with a gun. Shot her in the head. I understand. I'm not a gun advocate per se.
Sure.
All I'm saying is, okay, the Constitution is a document that is living, but it's not living at the whim of laws. Let the American people do what the Constitution says, get enough votes, and amend it to say, you can have guns, but these are the things that are going to be required in the Constitution. You'll never have peace in America. You'll have these factions until we can agree on something collectively like that. And as long as people feel that their rights with the Patriot Act, with now there's many with gun control, I don't particularly feel that way. That's just my idea to America.
I hear you. Well, listen, I appreciate the call, Brett. Thank you for calling in. Let's see what some of your other fellow patriots have to say about your comments, okay?
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. That's Brett calling from Denver, Colorado. Okay, opening up another Freedom Line here live on the Tom Hartman program as the Freedom Express continues to chug along right now at 1-866-987-THOM. That's 1-866-987-8466. Next up is David, and he's listening on Free Speech TV in the Ozarks. And welcome, David.
Hey, how you doing, Dr. Tom?
Hey, it's Dr. Mike.
Hi,
but
Dr. Mike, I'm sorry. But my mind was on Tom Hartman. I listen to him almost daily.
Oh, he's great. Tom's the best in the nation.
Yeah, and I appreciate the things he did, although I don't know much about him in the SDS back in the early days. I agree with your last caller too, that I'm not a gun advocate per se, but with the Patriot Act and all the talk about our government using drones on its own people, I think there is a call for it, and also the fact that our government has bought enough ammunition for them for the next 5 years.
Yeah, I don't agree with that drone stuff where the government can have drones just take somebody out if they suspect that you're a terrorist, particularly here in America, because that's what we were just talking about before, right? Habeas corpus. You can't just go out there and say, oh, I think that guy's a terrorist or he's a criminal. I'm just going to snuff him out without due process, without a right to a lawyer or a trial or a judge or a hearing. And
well,
you know, I don't think that drone thing's
with you too, Dr. Mike, that like the government does do things sparse. But when the government starts acting in ways which they're going to start putting limits on our rights and making laws taking things away. We have to be really careful how this is.
Well, you got to always be vigilant. You have to be vigilant when any entity or any body tries to limit your rights. Like you said earlier, like we did say earlier, a right is a right. A right should never be voted on because it is a right. So if you start having lawyers or you have legislators starting to infringe upon those rights, like you said, or limit those rights, or in certain cases is take those rights away, then, yeah, that's when the government is not operating the way that it was envisioned by the founding fathers, and that's when we, the people, need to take action. And what I mean by that is not a call to arms or violence, but a call to the ballot box. So, listen, I got to run. I appreciate the call. Thanks a lot for calling in today.
Hey, Mike.
Yes, sir.
When the one man asked for shorter work weeks today.
Oh, no. I gotta go. All right, listen, 1-866-987-8466. We'll be back in a moment.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Dr. Mike Newcomb sitting in for Tom Hartman, and you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back. Let's get right to the Freedom Lines. First up is Laura from Albuquerque, New Mexico, listening in on 1350 AM. Laura, welcome to the Tom Hartman Program.
Thank you. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, it's a little hard on callers like me when I call in about the abortion question, and you have so many other discussions, I could talk about any one of them.
I know. Isn't that the fun of it, though? It's just like we're all a bunch of friends hanging around a table and shooting the breeze.
Right. Well, let me start with my comment on abortion, if I can. I've heard a lot about this abortion question and birth control, mm-hmm. and I'm sure I haven't heard nearly as much as you have about it. But, you know, I think we need to start a new conversation.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I can tell from the recent statistics, 20,000 girls under the age of 15 get pregnant in America every year.
Okay.
Three-quarters of them will have an abortion. One-fourth will carry their child to term and have it. When I was coming along, we had something called statutory rape. But I think we need to start a new conversation. We need to start a conversation about who's having sex with our children. We keep talking about our children or our future and how important they are, that we protect them and all, but nobody is talking about who is having sex with 10 and 11, 12-year-old girls.
Well, look, obviously when kids are that young and they're pregnant, clearly, you know, you have to ask the question, you're correct, you know, they're underage and they are pregnant, and who is the person who participated in that act with that child? I mean, you got to make sure, like you said, that they, you know, not only statutorily, right, we're in rape, period, you know, because often when they're that young, kids can't really speak for themselves. So I don't necessarily disagree with you in that sense that conversation needs to be had, and why, even more importantly, why are kids that at that young age having sexual intercourse? I mean, to me, you know, as a father and a parent, I think when kids are, you know, 13, 14 years old, I do think that's way too young for kids to be participating in sexual intercourse. And a lot of it has to do with our society today. A lot of it has to do with the values. I mean, look, everywhere you look, Laura, there's no question in my mind. And I do agree with this, that I think there's way too much gratuitous sex, too much violence on TV. I mean, you see sex everywhere, whether you are opening up a local newspaper and you see women scantily clad in lingerie.
By a magazine rack at the store.
Walking by a magazine rack, on cable television, everywhere you turn, there is sex, 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 and that's what these kids see. And at the very same time, Laura, you look at our education system and you look at the national rankings for American students when it comes to basic fundamental skills like math and reading and science, and we continue to slide lower and lower and lower, and other countries are surpassing us because guess what? These kids are coming from communities where education is valued, where they don't spend their time idly with video games or watching things things that are pornographic or have to do with, you know, gratuitous sexual encounters. So I agree that that conversation needs to be had, and that doesn't need to be a partisan conversation. That doesn't have to be a conversation that's Democratic or Republican or liberal or conservative. That's a conversation about fundamental values and how we want to raise our children and what type of environments are conducive for these kids growing up and becoming good, productive, honest citizens and participants in the human species. So I agree with you, Larsa. Thanks a lot for that call. I appreciate it.
Yeah, let me bring one more issue, because really I feel like so many of these conversations have centered around the woman.
Right.
And I really think they need – we need to open this conversation up and talk about the men involved.
Absolutely. I did that yesterday. I spoke about how men need to take ownership and responsibility, too, in these particular types of relations, not underage relationships, but I'm saying consenting adults, that when you have a sexual relation and you know what the potential outcome could be, you know, a man can't just turn a blind eye and a deaf ear to the woman and say, hey, sorry, it's your problem. You know, I'm not going to deal with it. I'm not going to provide financial support, emotional support, you know, love or compassion for you. You're on your own, and I didn't plan this. So a lot of times women do feel left out and vulnerable as a result of that. So listen, Laura, I do appreciate that call. I'm going to get to some of the other callers let me get that number, 866-987-8466. But speaking of the abortion conversation, let me get to this quickly, because I got this email from one of the listeners yesterday, and she said, today, you know, you had an anti-abortion guest who splattered a bunch of nonsense and lies about abortion and about Planned Parenthood. She says, you did not rebut her properly. I suggest in the future that you do not have right-wingers on the show unless you're able to destroy their arguments. And so then she goes on to say about life and when life begins, and I thought this was a very curious perspective, because I don't necessarily agree with her with this, but she goes, the fetus, and these are all in capital letters, the fetus, in bold too, the fetus is simply part of a woman's body until it is born. It has the potential to become a separate human being, but it is not, all capital letters, a separate living person until it is born. It may have a heartbeat, but that heartbeat is completely dependent upon the woman. Its cells may be living matter, but so are the cells of a broccoli plant or a bacteria. It does not matter if that fetus could live independently of the woman. And then again, all bold, all capitals, until it is out of the woman, it is part of the woman's body. It is not an independent living person. You seriously need to integrate these concepts. So, Eric, I think this person is way out there. I disagree with her with respect to that, you know, it's not a living thing until it's outside the womb of the woman, and that the woman has, you know, every right up until right before when that baby. So if you're at 40 weeks is what, a normal pregnancy? So you're at 39 weeks, and it's, you
the
know.
The baby's pretty much developed at that point.
Well, that's what I'm saying. Say you're at 39 weeks, and there's only like 10 seconds left for it to be 40 weeks. You know, what this woman is saying is that, as far as she's concerned, that baby is, or that fetus, if you will, is not a live thing. It's inside the woman until it actually exits the womb, that the woman could, with 10 seconds left in the pregnancy, say, you know what?
I don't want it.
And at that point, you go in and have an abortion. I would say most reasonable people, even people who are
pro-choice,
would have to think that that is wrong. I mean, what about you? I don't think that's right.
I mean, you have a fully developed baby at that point. I would never think
right.
That.
So she's trying to say that until it is absolutely out of the woman, it doesn't matter, that the woman could do whatever she wants, you know, at the very, very, very end like that. I don't think that's kind of a reasonable approach. And then she ends with this. She goes, you seem to believe that no one ever wants an abortion. She goes, that's not true. Women want them, and many are happy to get them. Sometimes those zygotes, embryos, fetuses are like cancers to a woman. I was happy after my abortion, happy that my two living children would not have their lives hurt because we had another mouth to feed and clothe and educate. So, again, I think that's a little out there. I don't think people are happy to have abortions.
I mean, come on. It's a horrible procedure.
Right. This is what I'm saying. It's got to be, when I was saying it yesterday, it's got to be an incredible life-altering experience for anyone who has to make that choice. And for this woman to say that it doesn't matter, you know, even if it's at 39 weeks and 10 seconds left for 40 weeks, that as far as she's concerned, the woman can abort the baby right then. And then, oh, furthermore, by the way, I'm happy, and many women are happy to have abortions. I can't imagine.
No, I can't imagine one woman being happy to have that.
Right. Done. Rejoicing, celebrating, high-fiving. Hey, I just, you know, terminated another one. You know, come on, give me five. Way to go.
How many? So fun.
That's so fun. I can't wait to get pregnant again and, you know, just be happy and have another abortion. So Marilyn, I wanted to read your email on the air live, and we'll see what everybody else has to say, but I have to respectfully disagree with you. I thought we had a very good, engaging conversation with the conservative blogger.
And she didn't walk all over you in that conversation yesterday.
No,
you did a pretty good job defending your what you believe.
By no means. But I thought this was a kind of very interesting perspective on the whole pro-choice issue. So, look, we'll see what people have to say. Let's get back to the Freedom Lines right now on the Tom Hartman program. Let me see who's next up in the queue. I believe it is Esther on the line from Angleton, Texas, and listening on Sirius XM Satellite Radio. Welcome, Esther.
Yes, sir. Dr. Mike.
Hello, Esther.
Hey, I watch a lot of stuff, and I've been watching what Rand Paul's been doing.
Right.
And, yeah, he's from my district right here in Texas. And he's a senator of Kentucky.
Well,
even though Mitch McConnell went after Ashley Judd really hard about her mental and emotional situation and how she was from Tennessee and how she would be affiliated with Kentucky. Well, I want to know how Rand Paul can be affiliated with Kentucky. The man is an obstructionist. He does nothing but filibuster. And he puts himself out there. He wants to be president. I guess he picked up the mantra from Ron Paul.
His dad, right?
I like, and I voted for. I voted for Ron Paul because I like some of his ideas about getting out of Iraq. And we shouldn't be doing this or doing that. But
no, I agree. Yeah. Actually, Congressman Ron Paul, the father, the doctor, had some kind of interesting perspectives on things that I would agree with you, that I agree with him, too. I loved his anti-war stance. I, you know, was totally in sync with that.
Yeah. Yeah, but Rand Paul, I mean, we need to put that out there, that the man is not, has no allegiance to Kentucky. But however he got in there, I have no clue.
Yeah, well, this it happens. Look, our own person, Hillary Clinton, she was not necessarily from New York, you know, but she ended up going to New York and becoming U.S. Senator. So they're free to move wherever they want in the country and then run for Congress, you know. So, but listen, I appreciate the call, Esther. I got to run. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye.
All right, bye-bye. Okay, the Freedom Express pulling up to its final stop, its final destination for today. Back with your final calls.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Broadcasting from 1480 KPHX, you're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Okay, welcome back to the final segment for today. Let's get to the Freedom Lines. Let's see, first up in the queue is Annalisa calling from Carson City, Nevada on Free Speech TV. Annalisa, welcome to the Tom Hartman program.
Hi, welcome to you, sir. I have to call about a caller who called in yesterday, a male caller. He left me absolutely flabbergasted.
Uh-oh.
He turned around and he said we should use the abortion issue as a trade for higher taxes with the Republicans.
Right, I remember that.
Just automatically saying, yeah, let's make women second-class citizens, period. You know,
use your uteruses as a bargaining chip for tax policy.
Yes, for higher taxes on the rich. And all I could think is, the thing that comes to my mind is, if men could carry children, this wouldn't be an issue in the first place. It would be dead on arrival. It's that simple. Men are just frustrated that they cannot control the birth and the mere fact that this planet is so overpopulated. Oh, and the other thing that I find infuriating is anyone who's on a male who is on Social Security, his Viagra and all his stimulus pills, that he can get reimbursed for from Social Security. But God forbid we should have any contraceptives in any way, shape, or form for women. Or the mere fact that the RU486, I believe it's called, the day after pill.
Right, Plan B.
That Plan B, that's been legal over in Europe for over a decade now.
Right, and it's very safe, and I agree. Yeah, it's interesting how men look at the so-called stimulus package there, right, as far as the Viagra and things like that. It's interesting. Hey, let me ask you just one other quick question. You heard me read that email from that woman that did you just hear that email I read, Annalisa?
Well, I'm not sure, sir.
All right, well, don't worry about it. Don't worry. I thought if you heard, I was going to ask you a question. All right, listen, I got a lot of other calls. I appreciate the call. Thanks for calling in today.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for filling in for Tom. You're great, too, sir.
Thank you. Okay, there you have it. All right, let's go back to some of the other callers. And, Eric, there's somebody here from, it looks like, Iowa. What's IA? Is that Iowa? Right, that's Iowa. Ideas, I know. She's asking, when did Dr. Mike and Eric have an abortion? Did we ever say we had an abortion on the air?
No, I don't recall that. I can most certainly tell you that I have not had an abortion.
And I can almost certainly say that I haven't. Well, let's ask Jane. She's listening on Sirius from Estherville, Iowa. So, Jane, welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Yes.
Well, what I was referring to is you both mentioned how horrible and painful it was. I wondered when you had one that you knew that.
No, but I've known people who've had them, and nobody that I've ever met who's had an abortion
walks out of that building with a smile on their face.
Right, and confided to me that they were very happy to have an abortion. Now maybe I'm wrong, Jane. Maybe the woman who sent me the email is correct that just millions upon millions of women just really relish the opportunity to have an abortion and take great pride in enjoying that. Is that kind of what you're saying?
I'm not saying that they did, but. But for you to make a blanket statement, that's as bad as the woman's email that you read.
Well, let me tell you something. If somebody is very happy to have an abortion, I would personally feel that person's a pretty sick pup, to be honest with you. I mean, if somebody thinks...
That's your opinion.
I know. Of course it's my opinion. That's why they call it talk radio. Everybody expresses their opinion. But, I mean, do you think women in general are happy to have abortions?
Oh, I don't think they're happy. But I think part of the problem is that men... say what women feel, and they don't know. You don't know what it's like to have a baby.
Well, I mean, you know, that's not true either. I mean, I have children, and, I've actually delivered babies in my training, so I kind of know what it's like. I don't know what it feels like, you know, but, you know.
You don't know what it feels like to have a baby.
Okay. All right, Jane. Well, we appreciate it. Thanks for calling in.
Yesterday you had a woman on from Arkansas, Illinois, that talked about going to this clinic, but it was a Christian clinic, and how they showed these horrific abortion things.
Correct.
Did it ever occur to her that they might have been a little slanted?
Well, of course. I'm sure they were very much slanted. That's why I brought
you
up the whole point.
You didn't mention that.
I did. That's why I said, look, I could do the same thing to dissuade you from having a surgery by showing you all the bloods and guts and gore and stuff like that. If you want to get a heart bypass surgery, I can say, Jane, here, look at this. I'm going to, you know, wire your eyes wide open like they did in Clockwork Orange, and I'm going to make you watch these horrible surgery films, and I guarantee you probably won't have surgery again. So there's all kinds of way to utilize propaganda to intimidate and make people fearful. But any case, listen, Jen, I do appreciate the call. Honestly, I'm going to get to some of the other people, too, right now who have called in because we're coming up on the final stop for today. So let me just see here, Eric. Let's go to Harvey. Harvey has been holding pretty long, too, there and wants to talk about insurance for guns. Harvey, welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Mike. Yes, I'd like to tell you why I think gun insurance is so important. And as far as I'm concerned, the gun industry is the poster child for privatizing profits and socializing losses. And it turns out that thousands and thousands of people who get shot every year do not have health insurance, and they end up in emergency. And as you know, some of those operations can run up into the hundreds of thousands. And we, the taxpayers, end up paying for these. We pick up the tab on these shootings. And in the end of the year, year after year, we're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. And that's not the only thing. At the same time, many of these people who are who are shot, they're disabled for life. And they, again, you know, we the taxpayers, I feel sorry for them, and but we pick up the tab for their care and maintenance, and at the same time, we lose their production for life. So like, imagine if cars weren't insured and we had to pick up all the bills for the auto industry. And the insurance companies, they're always looking for new marketplaces, and who knows death and destruction better than the insurance industry? It's their bread and butter. So I say, you know, that we the taxpayers shouldn't have to pick up the
tab on that. All right, listen, Harvey, you got the last word on that, my friend, because we have to conclude today's program. As always, I want to thank everybody for weighing in with their thoughts, everybody for participating in the program. We will be back tomorrow. It's Bring It On Friday on the Tom Hartman program. Tag, you're it.
Listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.